Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, March 31st, 2025, and our friend Colonel Wilkerson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
Good to be back with you. I must say that I watched completely through your interview with Scott Ritter. That was pretty good. Scott was really on his data, on his facts. Good interview.
Yeah, about the conflict in Ukraine.
Right, yeah. And about the game going on right now between the boisterous, pompous, mercurial Trump and the steadfast, prudent, circumspect Putin.
Larry, let's start with what came out yesterday. And Donald Trump, for the first time, he says that he's going to bomb Iran. Here is what he said, and MSNBC reported on that.
President said he's also considering secondary tariffs if Iran doesn't agree to a nuclear deal. Quote, if they don't make a deal, there will be bombing, and it will be bombing the likes of which they have never seen before.
Yeah. And here is what he said. And on the other hand, we had the supreme leader of Iran responding to Donald Trump. He says that an attack from the outside is unlikely, but if they make a mistake, they will certainly suffer a heavy blow. And he said, he continued in that, he said, they're trying to do something inside the country. And what's your take, Larry? Do you think that Donald Trump is taking the situation, taking the possibility of having a war, a direct war, to the next level?
This is typical Trump, I think. This is standard Trump procedure. We call it SOP, standard operating procedure in the military. It's Trump. It's pure Trump. That's not to say that he could not be colossally stupid. He's proven he can do that in the past and act on one of his less than stellar cabinet officers' advice. And I hesitate to think that he would act on Hegseth's advice right now, because I think Hegseth is on his way out. Just a matter of time till Trump gets a little angry with all the things that are coming out about Petey Boy before he fires him. And I can't imagine the generals in the Pentagon going along with this kind of blasé interpretation. Let's confront facts here for a moment. We have bombed and bombed and bombed and bombed unconstitutionally, by the way. The Congress has not declared war on al-Ansar, on the Houthis. So we have bombed and bombed them nonetheless, and all my reports from Sana'a and elsewhere in Yemen say we have killed majority civilians, women and children included, that we have bombed residential areas, that our bombs have gone astray because the intelligence was not good, which I know all about. Doesn't matter how precise your munitions are if your intelligence is bad. So we have not disturbed the Houthis at all, in terms of their resolution and in terms of what they're trying to do to Israel and trying to do commerce to commerce in the Red Sea. We've taken some hits too. So now we're going to take on Iran. We're talking about escalating majorly. We're going against a nation state of 90 million people, homogeneous for the most part, will be totally homogeneous. Even those Baluchs up there who are constantly giving a problem on the border, or the Azeris or whatever, they'll come in and fight for Iran. And we're going to just bomb them into submission. I'm sorry. That just doesn't compute. As a military professional, as an erstwhile diplomat, that simply doesn't compute. So I have to conclude that Trump is not utterly stupid and that he's trying to bring more and more pressure to bear so that when they do sit down to talk, wherever it might be, and I'm confident they're doing it through outside good offices, outside channels right now. He thinks he has the leverage he needs to conclude a good deal. It'd be absolutely insane, Nima, to drop bombs on Iran. Absolutely insane. We would prove, substantiate to the entire American populace, and even more importantly, really, the globe, how insubstantial our military ability to influence Southwest Asia, other than through that attack dog Israel, truly is. And that attack dog Israel is in such deep trouble right now that I don't think they even can carry out our further mandates about destabilizing the Levant. So we're sort of in a trick bag right now when it comes to the Middle East and Southwest Asia. A trick bag, Nima, that we have designed for ourselves and pull the strings on.
Does he get the green light from the Pentagon to talk this way, or he just talk this way because he wants to talk?
I think one of the things he learned from his first administration, Nima, was he didn't want a green light from the Pentagon ever, not in terms of his mouth. His mouth is going to go wherever he thinks his mouth should go and whatever deal he thinks he's working on at the time. He subdued himself just a bit, as Scott Ritter kind of pointed out in the interview with him with Putin. And they've confined their remarks of substance, I think, now to telephone calls and perhaps some other ways that they communicate through Witkoff or whomever. So he's off this kind of braggadocio with Putin. Good thing there, because Putin doesn't respond to that at all, except to laugh. But he's on it. He's on it North Korea style with Iran. I think it's probably, to a certain extent, if he's been getting good briefings from Hegseth, he's probably somewhat irritated by the fact that the Pentagon went ahead and told him they could do real damage to the Houthis, and they have bombed, and all they've done, managed to do really, is kill a lot of civilians in an unlawful war. Totally unlawful war. I've been involved in this conflict and the War Powers Resolution Act and legislation to get us out of it ever since it started with the Saudis and the Emirates. And it's an illegal war. It was an illegal war then. It's doubly an illegal war now because we are a belligerent now. We are in that war. We are waging war against the Houthis.
Larry, we know that. How do they feel in Qatar? We know because there was an interview with the foreign minister of Qatar on Tucker Carlson. He said that we are totally against a war directly with Iran, that because they would be hugely influenced by that war.
Big time. They have and have been in a sort of running battle with the Emirates over this because the Emirates covets it. The singular Air Force base on the face of the earth in Qatar, Al-Udeid. And it is a massive part of America's military might, if you will, especially this throwing bombs at people in the region. And it gives America the empire, the opportunity to range with tanking even throughout the Eastern Mediterranean area, Syria, you name it. They would send missiles into that Air Force base that would nullify that Air Force base. I mean, it would be around the clock barrage. It would probably destroy good 50% of the aircraft there, especially if it were a surprise and they didn't get off the ground. And where are they going to send them if they get off the ground? I mean, back into Saudi Arabia, to some of the military city airfields or whatever, perhaps, but Iran could truly wreak havoc on the war waging capacity of the United States if it wanted to, not to mention the fact that it would send oil prices to 300 or plus barrel a barrel almost immediately as it took out Ras Tanur and other port facilities and oil field facilities themselves in Saudi Arabia. Talk about making bin Salman's plan go to hell in a heartbeat. I mean, this would just disrupt everything that Saudi Arabia is planning to do and wants to do, not to mention disrupt their entire 5, 10, 15-year planning cycles. So, I mean, we're looking at a country that, even if it were to go down, ultimately go down in the sense that we invaded and we have a war for a decade or so, and that would take the empire with it. So it'd be an imperial war, if you will, and we both go down. Even if we were to do that in the preparation for doing that, the destruction would be so great that the empire would be severely hampered and severely wounded, too. And I go back to that first set of war games that we did long ago, many years before Iran has the capacity that it has now, to sink U.S. aircraft carriers, to sink their escorts, to destroy Saudi Arabia's oil capacity, to do damage to major military Bahrain and the headquarters in Bahrain. And all these GCC countries are going to get, as Europe once thought it was going to get, if we executed O Plan 5000 and fought the Soviets in Western Europe, Germany, France, all of them knew they were going to go down, that they were going to get destroyed, especially if it went nuclear. Well, that's what's going to happen to every ally of the United States in the GCC, in Southwest Asia, in the area, including probably Israel. Because if I were Iran and I was going down, so to speak, and I was going to take everything out I possibly could on my way, I'd take Israel down too. Now, can they do all of that, given what they have? I don't know. I've looked at some of the assets that we're saying they have now, even publicly saying they have now. They could do a lot of damage, a hell of a lot of damage. It might be suicidal, ultimately, because when you take on the empire in a significant way that way, it might be suicidal for you as well as ultimately suicidal for the empire. But would they do it? I think they would. So I think this is all negotiating. It's all negotiating rhetoric.
What's the problem, Larry, in terms of the intelligence that they're receiving from Iran? It doesn't seem that they know what they're going to face if they go and bomb in Iran. And right now, from the Iranian media, I've learned that they're capable of attacking Diego Garcia's base and the base. Sure. There is no air defense system in that.
Nope. I'm sure they can range Diego Garcia. Not that in terms of ballistic missile distances, it's not that far. In terms of accuracy, I don't know just how accurate some of their warheads are, but I would suspect that if they were to send enough that way, they'd do a lot of damage, heck of a lot of damage.
And Larry, in terms of if you remember during the conflict in Ukraine, there was a crucial moment that the government in the United Kingdom, Starmer, went to the United States and talked and pushed for a direct conflict between NATO and Russia. We know in those days, Pentagon was so much mature, if we put it that way, so much wise in terms of interfering and not letting the Biden administration going to the wrong direction. Do you see that sort of force in the new administration, in the Trump administration, to be capable of doing the same thing if something goes wrong?
I certainly don't see it in what I would call the principles. And that's, in this case, those that would be most important would be the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor. I certainly, and the signals imbroglio doesn't strengthen my faith in them. But I still think in the bowels of the Pentagon, there's enough, he's eviscerated the chairman's office. I don't even know if this lunatic MAGA general, 3-star Raising Cane, is even there yet. I haven't seen any hearings. I haven't seen any confirmation hearings or anything. I don't even know who's acting. I guess the vice is acting as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff right now. There's a legal regime there. I don't know of the changes that have been made to it. I know what it was like when Powell was there and we had to put the vice in as the acting and so forth. But there's not a kernel of leadership that has a principal statutory responsibility to advise the secretary and the president in place, as far as I know, other than substitutes. And he's taking the JAGs out at the top of the services. That's the principal lawyers in each of the services. And he fired the CNO, of course, the woman who was CNO. So I don't know what that's done to the fabric of morale and discipline and so forth in the Pentagon. And of course, Hegseth is totally an unknown factor. He's a rank amateur. If you just listen to the discussion or read the transcript that they had in the signals conversation of note, you understand what an amateur he is. You got J.D. Vance and to a certain extent, Marco Rubio trying to actually restrain him. This is not good. This is not good. And other things I've seen of Hegseth, everything from his interview in Hawaii when he deplaned to other things that he's done, makes me think that he is a loose cannon on deck, as we used to say. I think he's short for the world. I think he'll probably be the first principal cabinet officer that Trump fires. You just don't embarrass Trump in the way that he has done and survive, in my view. So I can't answer your question other than to say I think the people, the colonels, the people who really make the Pentagon work are still advising what they were advising before with regard to both Russia and Iran. You do not want to touch this with a 10-foot pole if you don't have to. So don't make it so we have to.
And let's remember that the way that Bill Burns, before leaving Washington, he mentioned the nuclear program of Iran because they were really concerned about the new administration. That's why they made that public. And he just publicly mentioned the nuclear program of Iran. He's not advancing. He's not, they're not looking after nuclear bombs. But even the intelligence of the new administration has reported on that. And so when you look at the way that the intelligence is talking about Iran, the way that the president is talking about Iran.
There's two ways to look at this. Well, there's more than two ways. There's three or four ways. There's the fatwa, which I think I told you, their foreign minister then, who spoke fluent English with Ahmadinejad, came to Washington or came to New York for the G.
You're talking about Salehi.
Yeah. And he said, do you want me to go to the UN Security Council and sign it in blood? Do you want me to operationalize it? He said, a good English word, military word. I think there's that dimension. And then there's a dimension that we, I think, know with some confidence that Iran is probably 7 to 10 days away from spinning the old centrifuges and going from the 60 to 65% enrichment to 90 plus, which is enough to build a bomb. Now, whether or not they've put everything in place to build that bomb once that uranium is available, I don't know. I would suspect they have if they're smart. And it's deep, deep, deep underground. We cannot reach that. We simply cannot reach that. We couldn't reach it with a nuclear weapon. Maybe with 10 or 12 nuclear weapons. I'm not even sure that would do it. North Koreans taught them a lot. So there's that dimension. But I think the intelligence estimate is still solid. They are not going to make the decision to go that 6, 7, 10 days or whatever, finish it off and make a bomb unless they're in existential peril. And I think they probably set the apparatus up to where not only can they survive the bombing, they can do that work in the time frame that they're being bombed. And so they will present us with a fait accompli, which might be a mushroom cloud, perhaps Jerusalem. I'd do Tel Aviv if I were they. Anywhere Bibi is, I would do it. And I'm not advocating that, of course. I hate to even think about nuclear weapons being used in the world again. But that, and then there's a third dimension of it, which is, do they believe that they have the capability that I'm quite confident they have to make the empire look as feckless as the Houthis have, only against a much more formidable onslaught of air power, basically air power? Maybe some, what I would call ship power, said, Nima, we don't have the capability. Remember in the Eastern Mediterranean, the big New Jersey 16-inch guns that were shelling the Druze, shelling the mountains and everything? They might have been inaccurate as hell, but they were formidable weapons. We don't have anything like that now. All we could do is send a submarine and shoot some cruise missiles, or maybe a cruiser or whatever, and shoot some cruise missiles. They'd be gone pretty quickly, and we'd have to run and reload. So Iran, this is the old battle of ships and land-based installations. Unless you have a formidable set of circumstances that allows you to maneuver those ships and to fire your weapon systems and such without putting yourself in danger, the land batteries always have the advantage. So, and nothing's changed about that. So we would be losing ships at an alarming rate if Iran really wanted to get serious and we got close enough for them to do it. And close enough now, these hypervelocity missiles, Nima, will go a long way. Even the smaller ones will go 600 nautical miles. That's pretty deep into the Northern Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean. So, I mean, no one's thinking about this. Certainly not Trump. Trump wouldn't. If I were talking to Trump the way I'm talking to you, he would just get glassy-eyed. He wouldn't have any comprehension of what I was saying, but he would have comprehension of it after it started and the casualties started rolling in. So again, I go back to, I think this is all about negotiating. And perhaps it's even that way on the Iranian side. You know, they seem to be steadfast. You know, you're not going to threaten us. Increase sanctions, you know, your bombing threats and so forth. They're not going to threaten us. They're not going to threaten. I think underneath all that rhetoric, they're probably talking through emissaries, but they're talking.
Lori, you mentioned the situation with Yemen, but we know that in Lebanon as well, we have the same sort of situation that Macron is trying to do something. I don't know if he's honest in the way that he's expressing himself. But do you think the situation for the government in Lebanon is getting more difficult in terms of dealing with Israel? Because it doesn't seem that Israel is caring about them and the way that they're trying to solve this situation problem.
Extremely difficult, in my view, and extremely difficult for the government in Damascus as well. And the reason for this in Lebanon and Damascus to a certain extent, though the formidable military might has not gotten to the point where in Damascus I'd be trembling in my boots like in Beirut. Israel wants Lebanon. Let's face it. They want Lebanon. They either want it destroyed and gone or they want it for themselves. I think the latter is what they really want. And I think that's what they've wanted since 1982 when they invaded and they got their ass handed to them. Different circumstances today, though, and they've got a situation that looks conducive to going further to them. And so the Lebanese government, no matter what Macron says, or I think the United States is in there saying some things too. Hold on. Make sure your military does everything it possibly can to convince the Israelis that you are taking care of what remnants of Hezbollah might be still shooting. I understand it's probably people coming up from Syria and maybe elsewhere who are shooting up the Israelis now. But of course, the Israelis don't care. They'll say it's Lebanese. They'll say that the Lebanon army should be taking care of those things. And in terms of international procedure, yeah, the government in Beirut should not be allowing rockets to come out of their territory and hit another sovereign state. But this is a very difficult set of circumstances and very difficult for the new government to have that kind of hole. And the new Lebanese military, such as it is, it's not Hezbollah anymore. It's the standard Lebanese military, has some trouble with some of these people who want to shoot at Israel. And you can understand why they have trouble, because a lot of sympathy with the people who want to shoot at Israel. Very difficult position for Lebanon. Israel's going to settle it. Netanyahu thinks he's going to settle it. He's going to take as much of Lebanon as he can, particularly to protect those people in the north, because those people are leaving again. The few that came back are leaving again because they don't feel like they're safe. So everybody's got his hands full, but Netanyahu is the only one who's arrogant enough to think full hands is a good deal.
Lori, what's amazing to me is that why are we not hearing anything about the foreign minister of Israel? It seems that he doesn't exist.
Doesn't it?
Nothing.
Netanyahu is Israel's foreign minister. You know, just as surely as Tony Blinken was Bibi Netanyahu's assistant secretary of state, Netanyahu is foreign minister for Israel. Here's something Haaretz said yesterday. I don't know Channel 12 that well. I've paid attention to their polls before, but this is Israel's Channel 12. They just did a poll, and the way they asked their questions was pretty sharp, pretty good. A lot of polls are terrible because they don't ask the questions very well. Their questions were pretty good, and they found that 69% of Israelis, and I'm assuming that meant the 14.7 or 13.7, whatever it is now, between the river and the sea, that's both Arab and Christian and Jewish, 69% said they wanted the hostages back and the war over. That's almost three quarters of Israel's citizenship want the hostages back and the war over. More significant probably than that figure, only 20%. Opposed. So Netanyahu is living on that 20% now. That's what he is politically surviving on. And they are the radicals, of course. They're the ultimate. They're the Ben-Gavirs, the Smotriches, and others. I don't think that's sustainable. They are in the next phase of talks right now. My information this morning was that because of, I'm thinking what his name is, the American. I wrote it down here. I can't remember what it was. But because of the American and because of the four that are associated with him and would constitute the five in the next tranche where they go ahead, that the talks are at a point now where Israel, who's been the sticky thumb all through it, not Hamas, Israel, is looking at the present talk as favorable. So there might be a sort of a semi-ceasefire. Israel never honors any kind of ceasefire, but there might be a sort of not 300 people killed, you know, like yesterday, maybe 30 or 40 killed. But if that happens and we get five more hostages back and the rest of the deal were to be executed, which, as I understand it, is a few hostages every 10 days or something like that for maybe another 30 to 40 day extension, which both sides are looking favorably at. If this happens, if Netanyahu actually agrees to that, that's going to satiate some of that adverse polling he gets, maybe, but one wonders which way. But most of all, it's going to give Netanyahu a breathing period because he's really had a tight window here, had to get a budget passed, had to get the Knesset on his side, had to destroy the judicial system in Israel. By the way, one of the polling questions was about that. There's about 80% don't like that. So he's in a precarious position to a certain extent, as is the IDF. The desertions are up. I say desertions, they're really absent without leaves. They just don't show up. They're reservists chiefly, and they just don't show up. If they're repeaters or they're new people, they just don't show up. And that's causing a problem too for the IDF leadership. So we're in a pretty dicey period for both the leadership in place right now and for, I won't say Israel's democracy, it's gone. There is no democracy in Israel anymore. And I don't see it coming back anytime soon. And for Hamas, who've reconstituted, I think this is good intelligence. They have reconstituted. They have about the same amount of fighters, perhaps not quite as experienced, and the leadership perhaps is not quite as experienced, but roughly the same amount they had on October the 7th. So that's how Bibi has been so successful in accomplishing his mission of destroying Hamas. Impossible mission in the first place, but he's not even close. So, I mean, they could go on and on and on in this business about many Palestinians protesting Hamas. I'm sure there are some who do, but I think that's mostly Israeli propaganda. I saw an expose on it last night where it demonstrated how Israel had been mostly in there doing that. And you can't keep killing UNRWA, reporters, hospital people, doctors, nurses, and they're still killing people left and right who are in that 300 they just killed. Supposedly there were 17 or 18 journalists, doctors, others in there to provide humanitarian aid. You just can't keep doing this. I keep saying that because I keep thinking that sometime the world will wake up. Even the empire will wake up. Israelis will wake up and understand that they are destroying any concept whatsoever of being a state worthy of being in the world. They're just destroying it. All across the globe, they're destroying it. Putin has been getting, you've probably seen, Putin's been giving speeches on this. Xi Jinping's been giving speeches on it. They have got the world on their back for all intents and purposes, and they're going to find it very hard to divest themselves of that burden if they continue. I think they're going to have a hard time, period. But if they continue in this present mode, 59% of Americans now don't like Israel, period. Good polling question. Do you or do you not have affection for the state of Israel? 59%. no, in all categories, independent, Republican, Democrat, a little bit different in each category, but 59% of Americans. That goes up a percentage point, I dare say, every week. They're destroying themselves. They're destroying their entire apparatus in this country other than the bought and paid for United States Congress. And they're going to regret this. They truly are going to regret this. Anti-Semitism and all of its vibes with the Foundation for Defense of Douchebags to the Washington Near East Institute, another group of douchebags. All of that work is going to be for naught because the American people are going to turn wholesalely against Israel. I don't see how you can prevent that, really. I don't see how you can keep it from happening, given what is now available in alternative media. And sometimes I'm reading the New York Times differently now. The New York Times has even got some people talking about it. And that's a real accomplishment to get that bastion of state propaganda to talk about something like Gaza, like Lebanon, like Syria in realistic terms. When you've done that, you've accomplished something.
There are two options for the Trump administration: to support Netanyahu the way that the Biden administration was doing everything for him, or just let him to face the difficulties that he's making for himself and his administration. Do you think that we're still in the face of reevaluating the situation on the part of the Trump administration to see which way they would go, or they have decided about that they're going to support Netanyahu till the end?
You know, to a certain extent, Nima, that question begs a bigger question. Is Mearsheimer right or am I right? Is Israel doing our business in the Levant, or are we so captured by Israel and its money, which is our money coming back to us, that we can't get out of its embrace? You know what I think? I think the former. I think Israel is our attack dog. I think Israel is doing what we want them to do, given the strategic guidance that we have been operating under, ostensibly since Bill Clinton, but very assuredly since Joe Biden. And that is to keep the entire region in total chaos, or as near as possible, so that we can't have anybody contesting what it is we do not want contested, primarily the same strategic objective we've had all along. And I heard a Saudi, I forget who it was, talking about this the other day, and he put it in the right terms. Oil must flow through the Strait of Hormuz at a consistent rate, at a good price, and constantly. That's the real strategic objective that we want the region kept in chaos. Not enough chaos to disturb that flow, because that's what we are there for, to make sure it doesn't happen, but sufficient chaos to keep anyone from controlling that flow themselves, particularly Iran. That's our boogeyman right now. There are other strategic objectives too. Like I've said, we don't like this power seeping away to the east, to the BRICS, to China. The magnet, of course, is China. And we think this arc of chaos we've created from the Baltic down to the southern tip of the Persian Gulf will keep that from happening, because if you can't get out of that chaos, you can't establish a relationship with the Base Road Initiative. You can't take advantage of China's offerings. You can't establish a commercial relationship that's almost impregnable. And you can't, most importantly, shift your commercial focus from the West to the East. And this thing they're going to talk about and going to build coming up the Persian Gulf, this land route, it's the same route we used to resupply the Soviet Union during World War II, an old historic land route. When they restore that, then the Red Sea is inconsequential in many respects. The Suez Canal is inconsequential, because that's a better way to do it from the east than it is to do it over the oceans. We're going back to the past. This is a repeat of the past. This is what empires from the Persian to the Mogul to the Byzantine to, you know, that's what they battled over, these routes of commerce and so forth. And once you get one that outstrips another one, you become the real commercial power. And that's what they're shooting at. That's what BRICS is doing. And it's peaceful. They're not sanctioning anybody. They're not at war with anybody. We're the ones that are sanctioning a quarter of the world's population. We're the ones that want war or are sponsoring war. We've been at war with Russia now for what? Well, since the special military operation started, Ukraine hasn't been at war. They're our proxy.
You're talking about sanctions. Here is what Donald Trump said about Russia yesterday.
I can imagine.
President Trump called me to tell me he is, quote, pissed off with Russia's President Putin and threatened to impose secondary tariffs on Russia's oil. Quote, if Russia and I are unable to make a deal on stopping the bloodshed in Ukraine, and if I think it was Russia's fault, which it might not be, but if I think it was Russia's fault, I am going to put secondary tariffs on all oil coming out of Russia. Mr. Trump said 25% tariffs on Russian oil could happen any moment and told me he plans to speak with President Putin this week. The president told me, quote, I was very angry, pissed off when Putin started getting into Zelensky's credibility and started talking about new leadership in Ukraine.
Zelensky's credibility. Larry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I wonder how he feels about the Permian Basin reports that they're running out of the fracked oil. And now we've got this little country down there in the off the coast of South America that ExxonMobil has made a miraculous discovery at. So now we're going to bleed them to death. They were the environmental champion of the Western Hemisphere. Now they're going to be a petro state. Why are they going to be a petro state? Because you just can't turn down ExxonMobil. But, you know, the oil world is shifting so fast that I would laugh at him if I were Putin. I'd get on. Putin won't do this. Putin's too circumspect. But I'd put Medvedev maybe on the telephone, tell him to call Putin or call Trump, and if he can get him, tell him to blow his sanctions out his rear end. You know, go talk to Ottawa. Yeah, talk to them about the sanctions they're putting on the oil coming down to us now, or the tariffs they're going to put on it. We've started this. Trump started this. He is going to rue the day he started this, because he's doing it in the face of very dicey global economic circumstances. Even the Davos crowd knows this. Even the billionaires and the oligarchs in each of the countries in the world where there are billionaires galore, like Israel and like America. And like Russia, for that matter, they know this. They know the crunch is coming. They are all moving now to sell short, to get their positions going so they can survive this economic crisis that's coming. Okay, keep going, Trump. You're just deepening and making more profound what's going to happen to the empire when the crunch comes. And it's going to come before Trump's term is over. He isn't going to want. You know, he's talking now about orchestrating a way to have a third term, maybe not staying in power, but he wants to change the Constitution or whatever, you know. Okay, fine. He won't want to stay in power when this hits. It is going to be dramatically bad, particularly for the empire and for Europe.
By the way, the difference, Larry, that the main source of discussion between the two parties is Zelensky. And why is Zelensky so important for Donald Trump? Is he really, is it all about Zelensky, or is it all about the way that the British government is putting pressure on Trump and convincing him maybe that Zelensky is the future? Zelensky is not the past, is the future for Ukraine.
I think Trump cares nothing for London, nothing for Starmer, nothing for England. I'm not sure he cares anything for Britain. I think Trump is angry because Putin hadn't completely folded in terms of his demands about the ceasefire, which are very self-defeating for the empire, because it doesn't look like Trump won. Doesn't look like he really got a very good deal. And Putin has pushed the envelope to the point where Trump is beginning to realize himself, not just his advisors. Witkoff probably has advised him this way, I would guess, that he's walked himself into a buzzsaw, really, because whatever comes out of this, Putin is going to ensure, not because he's spiteful, maybe he is a little bit, I would be if I were he, but because he's smarter. He's going to come out of this on any deal that gets made. Trump is supposed to be the king of deals, looking brilliant, while the other side is going to look rather dim. And that's dawning on Trump. And he can't figure out how to get out of that inevitable denouement. And so he's striking in every direction that he can to try and disturb things, roil the water, if you will, that Putin has made fairly placid. I mean, he's adamant. This is what's going to have to happen. I listened to Sergey Lavrov talking yesterday, and he was talking about all manner of things, but he focused on the perfidy of the West. That's how I would label it. Now, I wanted to say when he talked about the Soviets coming in and liberating the concentration camps that they did and getting no credit for it whatsoever. Now, in fact, they're not even invited to the German sponsored ceremonies now that celebrate the day that, you know, it was opened and the people inside got out and so forth. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, well, Sergey, let me sit down with you and tell you about how a third to a half of the German women who had anything to do with the Soviet occupation zone in Germany were pregnant within 4 or 5 months from multiple rapes by Soviet soldiers. And the joke in Berlin was that a third of the population was Russo-German over the next 5 or 6 years. You know, that's your Russia, Sergey. But I didn't. I mean, there's balance, you know, there's arguments on both sides. But Sergey's right when he goes down the list of how we, the West, have treated Russia. He's right about that. No matter Russian crimes, there are plenty of Russian crimes. But he's right about the disgusting way that we have treated Russia. And he's right about the disgusting way, and he focused on this, that we have coddled Nazis. Let's face it. Alan Dulles and his boys took a half a dozen Nazis. Wernher von Braun, one of the top ones, their rocket scientists from Panamunda. We took them all on board. Operation Paperclip, all this good stuff we did. We made good with our enemy. Some of them we pulled right out of the Nuremberg trials because we didn't want them to die. We didn't want them to go to jail. We wanted them to work for us. So he's right about that. But this history is not known. 99% of Americans know nothing about this history. So as much as anything, Sergey was lecturing us on that history. And enough of it is true that you understand why Putin feels the way he does. Donald Trump does not do history. Donald Trump does not know anything about Russia, America, Europe, and the history. He knows nothing. I guarantee you he knows nothing. I could probably ask him a simple question, like how many Russians died in World War II. Give me a gross estimate. Do you know the Russians beat the Wehrmacht? We didn't. Donald knows nothing. So he's operating from an extraordinary deficit when operating against Sergey Lavrov, the longest serving foreign minister probably on the face of the earth, and one of the very best, and against Putin, who's a long-serving member of the leadership of Russia as well. So we're ephemeral. We go and come. We don't know crap about what we're talking about. They're solid. They know their history. They know the circumstances that pertain to Ukraine in their eyes in terms of it being a threat to them and such. We don't know any of that. And we did this all with a man who, and I shouldn't say a man, with four people, wink and blink and nod and nudge. Really, we did it with those people. We did all of this. We caused it all. And now Trump is trying to figure out how to get out of it. I commend his desire to get out of it. I commend his desire to do comprehensively the right thing. But I rue his procedure And I don't think he's going to be successful now because of that procedure. He just doesn't know what he's doing.
And the problem is that his administration is not that much wise to help him.
Nope.
And we know, Larry, I remember when Donald Trump was, he was choosing these people who were going to be, who are part of this administration right now. Everybody was talking about that the Trump experience, the experience he had during his first term has pushed him toward the new, these new people, mostly young people, to be part of this administration because he wants to manage everything, not getting order from the people. But the problem coming out of this administration would be they don't know about anything about the history. They don't know about anything about how they can help the president in order to bring some sort of sanity in terms of yesterday he was threatening Iran and Russia with new sanctions, tariffs, as he mentioned, and with bombing Iran, you know that Russia was under the sanctions, tremendous sanctions from the United States, more than 3 years that they're experiencing that. There is a fight going on in Ukraine. The United States is fighting. New York Times reported yesterday how much the United States is involved in Ukraine.
Yeah.
How deeply is involved in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And no, Russians know that.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised, Nima, that there aren't some people in Russia in the Lubyanka or other prison that we haven't told people about. They're American citizens. Later on, we'll let them know that they were innocent Wall Street Journal reporters caught on the street or something. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at all. And I wouldn't be surprised that Putin didn't dispatch some Americans in Kursk. I wouldn't be surprised at all because we were in the middle of that. We were in the middle of it, whether they were mercenaries or working for the United States in some way. I don't know. I suspect a little bit of both. But you're right. And when we do something like sanctions, I remember a deputy secretary of the Treasury for whom I had a lot of respect because he was also an international relations scholar, in addition to being deputy secretary of the Treasury and an economist, really smart man. I remember him telling me, do you know, Larry, we are so deep into sanctions at OFAC, Office of Financial Assets Control, which monitors our sanctions regime, that it would take a decade to unwind them. If the Congress were to suddenly say no more sanctions and unwind the ones that exist, it would take us 10 years to unwind them. There's such a labyrinth there. That's us. That's the way we do business. And there's no reason for about half those sanctions, no reason whatsoever. If we're going to get out of this in any way, fashion, or form that leaves the empire in anything but a few tatters rather than utterly on its way down, then he's going to have a new team. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And you can find people. Let's just look around for a minute. Who would make a really good Secretary of Defense? Now, I don't agree with this gentleman on every point that he makes. And I don't necessarily think he would be a panacea tomorrow morning, but over, say, another 3.5 years, I think he could do a really bang-up job. And that's Colonel Douglas McGregor. And he is disposed, or at least he was disposed, to work for Trump. And I understood from different sources that Trump was disposed towards him at one point. I think there's been a lot of alienation created here by what Trump has done and what McGregor has said. But nonetheless, my point is made. There's a sound, analytical, versed deeply in history, especially that history that matters right now, person to be Secretary of Defense. He had the best chairman that he could have had under the circumstances. He fired him. He got rid of him. We need a new one, and we need a good one. I don't think it would be palatable to call C.Q. Brown back, but let's get a good person in there, too. He needs a national security advisor who knows what he or she is doing, does not want the press, does not want the limelight, does not want to communicate over signal, and knows the issues in history. there are people like that around too. They are on college campuses. They're at Tufts. They're at Fletcher. They're around. You could pick one. Now you've got to pick one who's going to tell you when you got no clothes on, Mr. Emperor. So that would be very difficult for Trump, extremely difficult for Trump. Secretary of State, I think there are people around who would make good secretaries of state, both male and female, good people around. Again, some of them are on university campuses. Some of them are the kind of people you would say have been out there and done this and that, that makes them qualified, like Jim Baker. Remember Jim Baker, H.W. Bush's? A lot of people thought, well, why is he making Jim Baker secretary of state? One of the best secretaries of state we've ever had. A mild-mannered man, knew how to do diplomacy. Just knew how to do it in his Texas way. There are people like that. Trump doesn't want them. You nailed it. He doesn't want competence to compete with him. And competence would compete with him because he is fundamentally incompetent. It's a natural thing that competence would compete with him. But there are people like McGregor, for example, who at defense would mind his business well at defense, give Trump the best possible advice, probably resign himself if it were existential and Doug thought it was, and Trump went against that advice, which would be a signal to the American people that the president is nuts. There are people. We are not bereft of people who could form a good cabinet. They're just not the kind of people Republicans and Democrats routinely thrust forward because the two political parties are broken. Utterly, utterly broken.
I remember Donald Trump said various times, Larry, before the presidential election, when he was campaigning, he said that the sanctions are killing the United States. The sanctions are killing G7, and they're creating BRICS. But he came to power. And everybody was hoping that he's going to do something. He's the same old sort of strategy, policy, tactic, sanctioning Russia, Iran. And even if I don't know if you saw Pete Hegseth talking about how Japan going to join us to confront China. You see, they're not helping themselves.
No, no. And Japan, when I was chief of staff to Colin Powell, 2002, I think it was, I'd have to go look down on the wall because it was such a formidable copy of The Economist. They had, The Economist used to be really famous for their covers. This one came in to my office. It was my personal subscription, but I'm looking at the cover and I'm thinking, holy mackerel, has that encapsulated Japan in a photo? And it was a mask. It was a kabuki mask with a tear coming down from its cheek or from its eye across its cheek. And the title, as I recall overhead, was The Sad State of Japan or something like that. They've been in that sad state ever since. They haven't had a decent prime minister. Not really. They haven't had a decent policy. Not really. International policy or domestic policy. They are disappearing. They are aging themselves out of existence. Japan is a real imponderable in that region of the world right now. There's no reason whatsoever why both Korea and Japan shouldn't have China as their principal economic partner. Not that they should stop dealing with the United States. I'm not saying that, but they should be their principal economic partner. If you look at the stats, China is Korea's, and it's close with Japan. They have wandered into the empire's orbit, and they don't know how to get out, both of them. They think, and they have convinced at least a small percentage, small in Korea, probably a 50 to 60% percentage in Japan, that's the best possible security relationship on Earth, and it shouldn't be changed. They're wrong. They're wrong. There's no need for them to go down with the empire. But they are in a position to do just that, especially if the empire manages to create a war with China. They're not going to win. They're not going to win. They're going to lose just as badly as the empire. And the answer to that for Japan is not to go nuclear. That's not the answer. There are people in Japan who think that's the answer. And there are people in Korea who want that to be the answer, but that's because they're looking at a guy across the DMZ who's already got nuclear weapons. We've done this. Nima, we've done this. We've done this to our friends and allies all across the globe. And it's time they grew up. It's time they grew up and became their own man, so to speak, their own woman, whatever the parlance ought to be, their own state, their own country, and do the things that other states do. I'm not saying that we go back into a world where all these little states fight each other all the time, which worries me about Europe. It really worries me about Europe. You look at the history of Europe, and it's real easy to conclude that if we go to an attempt to build a security architecture for Europe that includes Russia, and it fails, and I'd give it a 50-50 chance only of success, then they all go back to the old of the old ways. We'll wind up with a Europe feuding with itself internally and a real mess. Doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to be, because we all have to confront two huge challenges, and we have to do it together: nuclear weapons and the climate crisis. And both challenges are going to kill us all if we don't handle them well. That ought to be enough pressure, enough existential circumstance, if you will, to keep us from going back to the kind of pre-World War I time and to make us work together. Work together in a way that China's ASEAN community idea promulgates. We're not in this to fight one another. We're in this to compete strategically, operationally, tactically, but not to fight each other. And may the best man win. And may we all win when it comes to those two threats that might destroy us all. That's the way to look at the future. And there are people in this country who would be a cabinet for Donald Trump who understand that. And Trump has said enough in that direction. He doesn't want a war with China. He wants to deal with China. He's said enough in that direction to where he should be able to take on a cabinet like that, manage it, let them do the heavy work, which requires good diplomacy, for example, and be successful. But my guess is, and it's an educated, informed guess, he won't. He won't. His bluster and his belligerence, his arrogance will not allow him to. And that's a shame, because there are a lot of people who voted for him who thought there was that prospect.
I don't know if Donald Trump knows what does ASEAN mean. If you remember, Pete Hegseth was asked, what does ASEAN mean? He said, what are the countries involved in ASEAN? He said, Australia? What's going on?
You know, for a person like me who was involved for five intense years, actually six or seven if you count my military time, in trying to convince the ASEAN leadership to have a security component, and failing, I now look back on that and say, what an idiot I was. What an idiot. Why was I trying to take one of the few organizations in the world that wanted to have nothing to do with armies and bombs and killing people, just wanted to be commercial, just wanted to have good relations, just wanted to produce profits? Why would I have wanted to turn them around and arm them? And yet that was part of my portfolio, to try and convince the ASEAN nations and the ASEAN leadership that they needed a security component. How wrong was I? They are the future.
Do you feel that the strategy is still the same, or they're just revising the strategy?
I don't think we care enough about ASEAN to be doing that sort of thing now. I'm not saying it hasn't fallen off. You know, I told you when I met with that senator in the Senate, I won't say her name. Oh, I said her name. There are only so many female senators. Anyway, she said we gave her a briefing on how paltry our efforts would be were we to have to go to war with China. And she had just come back from a tour of the Pacific with military handlers. And she started in her Pentagon provided propaganda. You know, we have surrounded them. We have them surrounded. We have everything around. We have Japan. We have Korea. We have Taiwan. We have Myanmar to a certain extent at that time. She thought we did. They've had an earthquake now. Maybe she'd change her mind. But we have all these people around them. We have the Seventh Fleet. We have all these things. We have the Philippines. We have, oh, man, we're out there in the Pacific. We're rebuilding this line out there. And I wanted to say, Senator, you're on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and you're looking forward to a war with China. And you think we're doing everything possible to win that war. Why am I, as an American citizen, appalled? Do your constituents know you think this way?
War with China would be a recipe.
She's been bought and paid for by the Pentagon in terms of that. I mean, I think we disabused her a little bit. We were supposed to go back for a subsequent briefing to kind of hammer it home. We haven't been invited. That was almost 6 months ago. We haven't been invited back.
Larry, do you think that, just to wrap up this session, Trump administration is feeling, we know that you've mentioned that he's playing a game with Iran and maybe with Russia, but what are the consequences of this game? Are they putting pressure on them and convincing them their future is together, is not just the way, because Donald Trump is interested in separating them?
Well, the consequences for Europe, immediate consequences, if there is failure here, is an even more rump Ukraine that will have a hard time even existing, and will have cheek and jowl with a very powerful CSTO if we don't do something to adjust the security architecture. I'd like to get rid of NATO, get rid of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, merge them, so to speak, bring Russia into that architecture and also Washington into that architecture and have an overhanging European security architecture that we could both back away from, with the possible exception of our nuclear umbrellas, and, you know, say, okay, this is the way we're going to operate from now on. And this is a defensive organization. It's not an offensive organization. So go away, Jens Stoltenberg and all people like you. But it isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen. So the best we can do is try to manage it, try to manage the collapse of NATO, try to manage the transatlantic relationship, which might go along with it. Look at what the relationship between our neighbor to the north and us is now, just in a few months. I have good friends in Toronto and Ottawa and Waterloo and elsewhere. I've never heard some of the remarks come from Canadians before, like I'm hearing now. I'm even hearing similar remarks from Australia, from people who don't like the current government because of its kowtowing, especially over Gaza, to the current Washington administration. And these people are going to be in control in Australia in a while. And so, you know, we're really damaging lots of things around the world in terms of our relationships. And it's this imperial egg-headedness, wooden-headedness, whatever you want to call it, that we're demonstrating. And Trump promised to the contrary, domestically and internationally, is not living up to that promise. And he's only been in office since January the 20th. People are already concluding that they might have cast their vote a different way. The Republican Party is scared to death right now of what's coming in terms of the midterms and even these special elections. They think they're going to lose quite a few and maybe lose the House.
The market is not doing well.
No, and that too. And these tariffs aren't helping, and the uncertainty they create. I had an economist who I would call John Maynard Keynes's disciple par excellence tell me one time that the factor that one should watch, especially if one weren't an economist like me, I'm not, the factor that one should watch most closely was not stock markets, bond markets, corporate profits, was uncertainty. when uncertainty reaches a certain point in a population, that's when you have disaster. And we are building that uncertainty brick by brick, day by day, tariff by tariff.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Good to be with you. How are you doing down there in Brazil? Okay?
Doing great.
Good, good.
Everything's gone.
Sometimes I wish I were down there with you.
Welcome.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.